Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, Maryland Congresswoman April McLean Delaney comes to the studio to discuss the scheduled closure of the Beltsville Ag Research Center in Maryland and the Farm Bill passing the full House. But first, here are this week's headlines. The Justice Department is investigating major beef processors for potential antitrust violations. At a press conference, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche said the DOJ has reviewed over 3 million documents, as well as hundreds of ranchers, cattlemen, producers, and processors. Blanche fell short of clarifying how close DOJ was to a lawsuit. The probe started in November after President Donald Trump asked for an investigation to be opened on the Big Four meat packers: Cargill, JBS, National Beef, and Tyson Foods. According to the Agriculture Department's Economic Research Service, the four companies handle 85% of all steer and heifer purchases. USDA is renaming and relocating the Food and Nutrition Service. Washington, D.C. area employees working for FNS will be moved to 8 locations around the country. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program will be relocated to Indianapolis, Child Nutrition Programs to Dallas, Supplemental Nutrition and Safety Programs to Kansas City, Missouri, and research programs will find a home in Raleigh, North Carolina. The agency will be renamed the Food and Nutrition Administration. Louisiana's crawfish sector is nearing a breaking point. A new American Farm Bureau Federation analysis shows that rising costs, cheap imports, and an unprecedented labor squeeze paired with extreme weather is putting immense pressure on the sector. Crawfish prices have barely moved in a decade, while production costs are up roughly 40% since 2014. Import competition has also intensified after anti-dumping duties lapsed in 2019. The Farm Bill passed out of the House last week without a vote of support from Maryland Congresswoman April McLean Delaney. We asked her why she didn't support the bill.
Passing the Farm Bill was a really important thing for me. I'm the only Marylander, we have tons of agriculture in Maryland, on the House Ag Bill, on the House Ag Committee. But you know what, this Farm Bill failed to meet the moment. And we are in a farming crisis, and just lifting up a little bit. Because of trade disruptions and supply chains, $25 billion have been lost by our farmers. There's a 46% increase in farm bankruptcies this year over last due to tariffs, workforce immigration issues, and USDA cuts. So this Farm Bill was really important to meet the moment in terms of being able to have a safety net for them, to make sure they have access to capital. But also, you know, they split apart SNAP and the big bill from the Farm Bill, and really cut across the bipartisanship of that. And so we felt in our office that it was really important that we kept on pushing for SNAP, because 1 in 9 families in my district, half of them children, depend on it. I mean, if our farmers sell into SNAP, but also because of the cuts to conservation, the cuts to technical assistance, and the relocations that are happening, there's gonna be less for our farmers in terms of technical assistance services, support services at USDA. And because of SNAP, there's gonna be a lot of cost sharing. There are almost $1 billion that are being shared by our state now for Maryland. So in good conscience, I could not vote for it.
Yeah, and we'll dive into some of those USDA relocations and the staff reductions there further in our interview. But, you know, one of the other issues we kind of tracked through the Farm Bill debate, and especially those amendments on the House floor, were those pesticide provisions. Mm-hmm. You know, Democrats were very fiercely opposed. Jim McGovern, who also serves in the committee with you, very fiercely opposed to that, as well as, but there's also a lot of MAHA-aligned Republicans that pushed back on
right,
that.
Right,
but
right.
Do you think that that kind of a coalition that formed against those pesticide provisions could maybe stop policy progress on any of those, you know, types of policies into the future?
Great question. Yes, I think that there is a coalition that is really pushing back against some of the pesticides, which is why we need BARC, and research to really look at how pesticides are impacting health, but also how they help our farmers grow. I mean, listen, we need some pesticides. I mean, we need to figure out about how all of those crops can grow most efficiently and effectively, but also how we protect health. And I'll just tell you one quick story. My dad was a potato farmer in Idaho. He used to come in with his whole body covered with yellow spray in the 70s. And my mom used to say, "Tom, that can't be good for you." "Oh, Laurel, it'd be okay. You know, they wouldn't sell it otherwise." My dad died a horrible death of an autoimmune disease, bleeding in bed with his skin peeling off. Horrible, horrible. And also skin cancer as well. But, you know, some of the things that they didn't have the warning labels on in the 70s really did have incredibly horrible adverse effects later in life. So my dad, in his early 80s, died a horrible death. And we know it was tied to some of the things that he was spraying on himself, and there was not a warning. So as a personal footnote for me, just warnings on pesticides is not a bad thing to have. And I think there's a pushback because obviously there's a lot of money involved, but we can both balance innovation and pest control and also the health of our farmers and those who eat the food.
I'm so sorry to hear about your father.
It's really awful. It was really an awful death. So, you know, that's a personal story for me.
Yeah. And as we turn to, so I guess the next steps for the Farm Bill, it moves to the Senate. And if it does pass there, you know, the next step is move to a conference committee where they'll reconcile the differences between the bill. But you mentioned those nutrition cuts. But as you look to your Senate colleagues that are going to be working on the bill, and if it does reach that conference committee, you know, are you hoping to continue to resend those nutrition cuts that we saw in budget reconciliation? Or what else do you hope gets changed or shifted in the bill as we move through this process?
Listen, one of the most, there's a couple things that I really think are important. I think, yes, some of the conservation, there's almost $1 billion in cuts to EQIP and some of those programs, which I think are really, really important. I think that some of the safety net for services for our and technical assistance services have been cut in part because of you know, all of the funding mechanisms that were put forth in some of the relocations from USDA. But I do think that the SNAP program is probably key because so many people, because there's been the tsunami of cuts, so many people are depending on that supplemental food nutrition. And many of these people do work. They just work at big box jobs or retail and they're not making ends meet. So if there was just a little bit extra SNAP, which also benefits our farmers who sell into it, if there was a little bit more in terms of EQIP, and for me, you know, it's the cost share to our states that is being forced. There's billions of dollars from the SNAP program that has been foisted from the federal government to the state government, and that's kind of an untenable long-term you know, burden.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
Some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. Maryland Congresswoman April McLean Delaney joined Newsmakers in August on the day the initial USDA reorganization plan was unveiled. That plan, which has now been enacted, closes the Beltsville Ag Research Center in Maryland and relocates more than 2,500 researchers. We asked her about the impact of the facility closure.
I really don't like it. You know, I think we all need to have bloat out of, you know, our agencies, but I think that we need to be very methodical. And I said this back in August when we spoke about how we do it. And I think these massive relocations to other places across the country, we a lot of our public servants are just not going to move. They don't want to uproot their lives and move to Utah or other places because they've spent most of their life here. So we are going to lose decades of institutional knowledge. And when we talk about the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center, which is it's just over the line from my district, but I kind of am representing all of Maryland. This is 100 years old. I mean, it is, you know, incredible research on pesticides, the screwworm, which is like attacking our livestock across this country, on nutrition and on conservation. And when we, you know, lose that, you know, it's not easy just to rebuild and repopulate. And my big thing has been about the National Bee Lab. I went out with Congressman Ivey and our senators and kind of you know, went through BARC with them, and I said, this is really important. You know, it needs some money, you know, to renovate it, but please don't close it down because of how much great research is done here. And I said, this bee lab, and they said, well, we're going to take those bees and we're going to send them to Utah. And I said, my mom's from Utah. It's called the Beehive State. But if you take those bees, which have been pollinating the same fauna and flora for decades, you know, you have to have a research constant. You will lose all the research and you can't move the trees. And I remember the young DOGE staffer kind of going, oh, I'll have to tell them that. And I said, oh, I said, we really need to think carefully about how research is preserved. And some of these things just can't be uprooted and transferred.
One of the big points that USDA has raised in this decision to close was, you know, the facilities being that old, needing a lot of repairs, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But you've toured the facility as well as Deputy Ag Secretary Stephen Baden, who's
Definitely needs repair. I mean, yeah. Across Washington, all of our, you know, from the CIA to the FBI. I mean, talk about any of our agencies, you know, even the Department of Commerce. They all need, of course, upkeep because many of these are older buildings. But that doesn't mean that we don't make the investments we need to. And it doesn't mean that you can't take a part of it and export it. But it's I think, this very quick relocation without really carefully thinking about the impact on the agricultural sector as a whole and on farmers specifically in terms of what they need. Also, when you do these relocations or, you know, and you have these cuts, you know, already our farmers don't feel like they don't have enough technical assistance or support services where they are. And many of the people who are left behind at USDA are doing the work of two or three employees that are being done now. And so that's only going to slow things a little bit more.
Yeah, and we've heard concern about just field offices even being mm-hmm. staffed for those farmer-focused programs. I mean, have you heard that in Maryland?
Yes,
you know,
of course.
Do you have concern about burn drains still?
It's happening. I mean, it's not, you know, going to happen. It's happening. And, you know, it really comes down to, do you believe in public servants who support the public interest and are there to become effective? Because if you just drain it and if you dismantle quickly, then people lose trust in that agency in the first place, which perhaps maybe for some is the point. But for me, and I think for many, USDA is a really important force of good. And I do believe the secretary believes that as well.
We'll be back with more newsmakers. But first, Andrew Hunneke takes a look at data centers across the U.S. in this week's Map It Out.
Demand for data centers is expanding as AI and other digital services continue to grow across the country. This map shows all of the 4,925 data centers that have already been built or that are being built in the U.S. according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. Virginia leads the way with 736, followed by Texas with 580. California, Georgia, Ohio, and Illinois all have more than 200. Many of these facilities are located or being built in rural areas, which means farmers have already lost or may lose valuable farmland. However, modern agriculture relies heavily on those data centers to provide the infrastructure needed to operate. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper for my brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put four kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
Welcome back. We're joined by Anthony Reed with FGS Global and Mike Strands with the National Farmers Union on our panel this week. To begin, Anthony, your round E15 was punted again when it was separated from the full Farm Bill vote last week. What's the path forward for the provision now?
So last week, obviously, I joked that we had the expansion of or voting on funding the government, foreign intelligence authorities, and the thing that overarched everything was E15, right? So it was the reason why they held up some of the rule votes and and some of the other provisions last week as they were trying to negotiate how the E15 package would get voted on and considered last week. And so they ultimately, after a lot of back and forth and holding votes open for about 5 hours, came to an agreement between the oil state representatives and the agriculture and ethanol side of the equation to move forward with a vote for next week. So they tentatively have scheduled a vote for May 13th on the same package. It was the Fischbach amendment to the Farm Bill last week, but now they're going to consider maybe decoupling it as an amendment to the Farm Bill and considering it as a standalone bill at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think this issue, especially within the last year or so, has been a lot to follow. The E15 Rural Domestic Energy Council has, you know, been working since January to push for those higher ethanol blend fuels. And, you know, as you mentioned, this fight has been going on well over a decade before that. But what needs to shift to really get this across the finish line? I mean, do you think that the conflict in Iran or, you know, what needs to shift from a policy perspective? Because it's been so close to the finish line so many times.
Yeah, and I listen, this is about as close as we've ever gotten. And where in previous time, you know, it was trying to get what really is just a technical correction to allow E15 to be sold year round. It's a lower volatility fuel than E10, which most people fill up every day. So there's no real policy reason not to allow it. But the reality of the politics has been that there's a deal needed to be struck with some of the folks who represent some of the oil interests to try and get this unlocked and move forward. And the deal that they have on the table that will likely get voted on, I mean, you have the API, you have growth and RFA, you have the commodity groups, including Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, you have gasoline and diesel retailers. So, I mean, you have just a huge swath of the supply chains in the fuel space all on board with this. And as you said, this is the gas price vote of 2026, in my mind. You can get E15 for 30 cents to a dollar cheaper than gas. It's 20-year lows relative to gasoline ethanol is today. So there's every reason to do it. And they have all of the stakeholders basically at the table, except for a handful. But because there's such a small margin of error in the House with the votes the way they are, that's really made it a challenge.
Yeah, and Mike, we'll bring you the conversation, maybe a sigh of relief that the Farm Bill is finally through the full House, but that really turns all eyes to the Senate and what happens with the bill there. You know, where do you expect quite a few of those Farm Bill fights, I'll say, that we saw in the House, but where do you expect those fights to tee up in the Senate? What will you be watching?
It was a good step forward to see that progress in the House. Been quite a few years, 8 years since we've seen this much Farm Bill progress. That said, there's some important things that need to be addressed in the Senate discussion and debate around the Farm Bill. Some of the things that were either left on the cutting room floor or didn't make it through rules for House amendments. So we need to make sure that the magnitude of the moment we're in right now is being matched by the farm policy changes and adjustments in this Farm Bill. Next week, the Senate's going to have a hearing, Senate Ag Committee is going to have a hearing on fertilizer costs. We need to see that sort of issue addressed in the Farm Bill. The same goes for other skyrocketing input costs on the fuel side, and that gets back to 15 and all that too. We need to make sure that we're addressing the trade realities we're in right now and some of the uncertainties about imports for that matter, and how mandatory country of origin labeling for beef could go a long ways to assuring consumers and giving producers a fair shake in the marketplace. And we need to make sure that our farm policies, the farm safety net, is keeping pace with what we have on the ground today and what we're going to have in the coming years. So some of these updates need to be part of a Farm Bill. We also know that there's going to be a lot of debate, and there's already been some pretty direct signaling from Senate Democrats about the need for adjustments to how nutrition programs work, particularly on the cost shares with states that were put into place during the reconciliation bill last year.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper for my brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. Pesticide language was stripped from the House version of the Farm Bill. I asked Mike Strands with the National Farmers Union how he sees that issue faring in the Senate and into the future.
I think there's a fair amount of building concern about how monopolies in the marketplace are treated. And if they're given a free pass on some of the liability concerns out there, I think that is a topic that goes to segments of Republicans, a segment of Democrats, and of independents certainly as well. So it was an interesting fight to see play out on that Luna amendment on the House side. And I expect it's probably not going away, but I think that it did clear a path for this bill to move forward through the House.
Anthony, I want to get your thoughts as well. Senator Hovind said earlier this year that he'd like to see Round E15 included in a farm bill. That's not under the jurisdiction of the Ag Committee, but certainly one thing very important to a lot of those farm state members that sit on the Ag Committee. How do you see this E15 fight potentially playing out in the Senate where they'll ultimately need 60 votes to pass?
Yeah, so I think the first step is trying to get it a positive vote out of the House to send a strong signal that the House is in favor of this deal and having it move forward. And so, we'll have to see what happens next week with the rule for consideration, whether it's formally attached to the House Farm Bill, whether it will be attached to that. Some of the other, you mentioned Senator Hovind and others have raised the idea of if they do an ag disaster package of some kind, would E15 be a good candidate for that? So I think it really just depends on what legislative vehicles are moving and the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, and Mike, as we wrap up here, Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins joined Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche this week for an event focused on the DOJ investigation of meat packers. This isn't the first administration to really investigate monopolies, especially in meat packing, but what do you see that's different about this investigation and what will you be watching?
Sure, we're glad to see further investigation here and to continue on the efforts that the first Trump administration did, the Biden administration, certainly where we are now. Parts about that discussion earlier this week with the Secretary and the Attorney General, Acting Attorney General, was around the Agristats case, and we know that it plays a central role in figuring out and getting to the bottom of some of the concerns that are out there about the beef and other protein markets. And the announcement or discussion about how there would be a settlement coming in the future weeks, that's pretty newsworthy. I mean, we need to make sure this is a strong settlement and not one that undercuts future investigations.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Hunneke looks at supplemental disaster relief program payments in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
USDA has increased supplemental disaster relief program payments from 35% to 70%, triggering a second round of payments for farmers. This chart shows how those payments have been broken down by crop type. USDA has distributed approximately $6.7 billion of the roughly $16.1 billion authorized for the program, leaving roughly $9.4 billion, or 58%, for additional payments, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. Row crops have received 88%, about $6 billion of the total. Specialty crop producers have only gotten about $651 million, or 10%, so far. Forage crops have received about $142 million, or 2%. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issue Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place June 2nd in Sacramento. See the latest information and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this Farm State of Mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate will be in session next week, and USDA's crop progress report will be released on Monday. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.